Welcome to the Consulting Pipeline Podcast. My guest today is Anthony English, and I just got off the call with Anthony, and I was just really struck, amazed, humbled by his transparency, his honesty about the ups and downs of, I don't know what to call it, I guess the journey. You know, the journey of bootstrapping a services business a bit later in life at a point where you're just not sure what the next direction is because the platform where all your skill set was focused is not just, you know, deflating at the end of a bubble, but really reaching end of life. That was the situation Anthony found himself in, and I don't know, maybe some 3 years ago. And he talks about what he did next and this process of discovery and experimentation and trying and not always succeeding the first time, but this process of iteration to move from that situation towards something better. It's just a refreshingly frank view of what that journey can be like. And Anthony's not done yet. He's not there yet. He's not all the way at the destination of having the business he wants. We hear, I think, too many of those stories that are told at the end of the journey, where all the details and inconveniences of the journey are smoothed over and sort of lost in the warm glow of champagne bubbles and sunsets. I think there are not enough reports from the road along the journey. And this conversation with Anthony is very much that second thing. It's a report from the road. How are things out there? What are you trying as on your way to this destination that we're all trying to get to? And I think that makes this conversation with Anthony a really valuable, important conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Anthony English, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Philip. How long have we known each other? What, 3 years now?
I'm going to say that's about right. I think it's about 3 years. And I've been waiting for the moment when I get an email from you and the response for me is, hey, come be on the podcast. That moment has happened. So here we are. Why don't you tell folks who you are and what you do? We'll start with that. And there's a bit of a specialization journey story for you to tell, which I'm looking forward to hearing. So, Anthony English, who are you and what do you do?
Fairly wild specialization journey, I think, which I'm still on.
Yes.
So I have got a really strong IT background on enterprise systems, on IBM mid-range systems, and I was somewhat of a leader in that field certainly working on it for about 20 years. So mm-hmm. very, very technical background. Mm-hmm. And
would you say, like, is that what you always did? Like, say, post schooling, you just got right into doing work with IBM mid-range systems?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that early, okay. But I kind of fell into it and pretty much, you know, stayed with the one company till about 2007. I then went out contracting mm-hmm. with no real idea of what I was doing, and I call it contracting. In fact, yeah, I was just with recruiters, just going through recruiters on 6 month gigs, right? Mm-hmm. At what I now discover was a pretty low hourly rate, but I only found that out now. Yeah. So through all of that journey and, you know, the market downturns, I suppose 2 or 3 years ago, I realized these recruiters were really not that good at selling my services.
Okay.
And I thought, well, this is a problem because I can actually talk to the customer better than they can. But I didn't know how to sell. Mm-hmm. Did I? That's the story I told myself.
Right.
So I had a choice. I could see that the market, there was a downturn, a lot of things getting outsourced offshore. Mm-hmm. I either had to learn more technical stuff or learn to sell my services. And so I either had to go down a, you know, competing with all of the rest of the Indians and all of the others who were coming in much more cheaply, or else find a new way of, well, what Philip Morgan might call positioning. Yep.
So let's stop right there. So so you're in Australia, right?
I'm in Sydney, correct, okay. Yeah.
And when you said you had a choice between learning how to sell yourself and, or learning more technical skills, can you talk a little bit about what it looked like having, maybe this is not totally fair to say, but a sort of front row seat to the decline of a platform, right? Because the platform would be the IBM mid-range systems, AS400, stuff like that, right? And that market was declining, or what did it look like at that time?
Yeah. So very much for a lot of reasons that that I probably, you know, wasn't really aware of, it seemed to me that IBM was not necessarily pushing their platform. Mm-hmm. Things were moving to the cloud. Mm-hmm. A lot of bigger companies were just not really adopting the technology.
Right.
And remember that my positioning was a horizontal platform positioning.
Right.
Okay. So it wasn't the AS400, now known as the IBM i, but it was actually the I was going to say the poorer cousin. It was actually the richer cousin of that, which is AIX. And I so banks and, you know, fairly big companies were using that for their ERP systems.
Right.
And for so there was a lot of kind of the legacy talk happening, and I could, the writing was on the wall.
Okay.
So I had a choice. I either learn some new technology, which I probably could have done.
Sure.
Or I think, you know what? I'm wondering whether I've got some other skill outside of that technology that I can share.
Right. So, I'm going to keep trying to dig up a few more details about this sort of sunset moment for, you know, IBM mid-range stuff. So were you seeing, what specifically were you seeing? Were you seeing people say, wow, you're so expensive, we can get the same thing cheaper? Or like specifically, what were the signals you saw?
Right. So what I was seeing was that companies were, I suppose, just saying we are going to we're outsourcing the whole thing to an offshore that was okay. Typically India.
Okay.
And I was not really, remember, I wasn't speaking to with the end client, except when I was actually there working there as a contractor,
right,
through a recruiter. So I was just not, I just had no visibility of those decisions at that level.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was seeing was that there was, I wouldn't call it a depressed market, but just the whole, there were a lot of people just hanging on to hold on to their jobs.
Right.
Think, what can we learn to just basically to hold ourselves so that we don't fall off the cliff? How can we stop this from happening? What can we learn? What can we do? How can we redefine ourselves? And, you know, many people may have been made redundant, mm-hmm. contracts getting terminated. And I just thought, like, this does not look good to me.
Right, right. Okay, so there was plenty of evidence that this, you know, defining yourself as a platform specialist around AIX did not have a bright future for you or really anybody. It sounds like who was not an offshore sort of, I mean, back in the 90s, we would call them a body shop, just sort of supplying manpower with some amount of expertise, but not a lot of expertise, right? So that,
well,
go ahead.
Well, they may be, you know, highly expert. I'm not really sure. The ones in the offshore teams, but what I was seeing was that the communication there was a massive breakdown, and that was partly to do with time zones and mm-hmm. poor telephone lines, and you just, nobody, no one seemed to own anything.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, I'm talking to people. I was one of the very few people who was actually writing about this, about AIX, and not just about the technical side. I actually started positioning myself as, like, you know what, I'm going to start talking about the customer relations and, you know, how projects go wrong and how to work on a project when you've got 11 different companies involved and how to manage all of the politics of that. So very non-technical, more client-focused kind of language. And I was getting published, and I published in, I think, five online magazines around that, and was getting paid for that.
Right.
And so that told me, look, there are thousands of people in the world with the same skills that I have, but there was only a very, very small number who were actually writing about it. I thought, well, that's something that I can do. Maybe I should develop that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. So did that lead you to connecting with clients when you had that sort of different message around the business aspects, or where did that lead you next?
Yes. So what I did was, through our mutual friend, Brennan Dunn, I went into the Double Your Freelancing course, and I still remember the moment, Philip. I remember seeing Brennan, you know, advertising with it. He said it's a bit clickbaity, like, you know, how to double your rates. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, that sounds good. And I remember taking a lot of interest in marketing. I'd obviously had a little bit of experience in writing for other magazines, but I didn't have an email list. In fact, my email list is now, as of this interview, is effectively 1 month old.
Nice.
And as of 10 minutes ago, is up to 89 subscribers and counting.
That's awesome. I don't know what it feels like to you, but no one is born with an email list. Like, everyone has to grow it from the exact same starting point, which is zero. So you just celebrate every single new subscriber, I think. And, you know, before you know it, you have several hundred people listening to what you say.
Well, there are two things that are really important here. And I'm conscious that I still haven't told you what it is that I do. All I've told you is what I used to do.
Right.
But we'll get to that. But I remember that someone said that when bloggers die, they take two things with them. One is their reputation and the other is their email list. Mm. But I never took that seriously until literally a month ago.
Mm.
The other thing that I think has been a really big mental shift for me, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but let me head back. So we've come out of the technology, still struggling to get some money, and I think you've been on a few calls where I've been almost in tears, if not in tears, and just saying, like, where is my next dollar coming from, right?
Right.
I'm a father of a family, you know, husband, we've got seven children, and, you know, all the pressure is on me.
Right.
And so, and as you can tell, I'm older than I sound. And so I, just not having runway, like, there's just a whole lot of things that all seem to come together,
right,
which just adds to the pressure.
Right.
So as you can see, I've through the writing on the AIX thing, I started writing blogs and fairly random topics, but still broadly around how do you market yourself? How do you get that message out? How do you get people thinking and seeing that you're more than just a technical person?
Okay, can I stop you right there? I want to ask a few specifics about the blogging. I have a sense of where this is headed because you and I have stayed in touch throughout this process.
Sure.
So, but, you know, for the folks at home, I want you to maybe imagine yourself in Anthony's position at this part in the story, which is, I think it's fair to say, Anthony, you're feeling a little bit adrift, a little bit like, Well, I know what doesn't work, which is me selling, you know, consulting services around AIX. I know that doesn't work, or that's got a, that it's pretty soon going to be not working at all. But I don't know what the new direction is, right? I don't know where to focus. And so you're writing, how often are you writing at this time?
Well, my writing has escalated in the last month.
Okay.
I have written two complete email courses.
Wow.
I'm ready to write another one. Mm-hmm. And so I have turned one of those email courses into a book.
Mm-hmm.
I made a big song, and when I say a book, right, I printed it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I printed it out, and it's got a little bit of color on it. It's just... just 24 pages. It doesn't have a proper cover or no photo on it, no picture on it. And but just that fact and putting up an excited, totally unedited video on LinkedIn got 6,500 views.
Wow.
And just a burst of enthusiasm from people and encouragement from people.
That's great.
And so I thought, well, like, that's a thing now. It's a thing.
That's right. And marketing a thing is way different than marketing yourself, although I think we'll get into that a little bit. So, but back then, you know, when you were kind of in this uncertain place and you're writing about marketing yourself, I'm just kind of curious, are you writing something weekly or just whenever you feel like it, or what does the schedule look like?
Yeah, so I didn't have a schedule, very impulse-driven.
Okay, sure.
Lots and lots and lots of free calls with people who appreciated what I was doing, appreciated my advice,
yep.
Lots of free advice that I gave, but it didn't turn into business in any sense at all.
Right. Looking inward, did the writing help you think your way through the uncertainty, or was it any kind of feedback mechanism that helped you clarify uncertainty? And it's okay if it's not. I'm just curious because sometimes it does serve that function.
Absolutely. I'm on one thing that I has been extremely liberating in the last month. And as you can hear, we're just getting interviewed now, or you're just interviewing me now, and it's quite fortunate that it's at this time, because I've made a lot of progress in the last month, as you can tell.
Yes.
In terms of procrastination, in terms of the shiny new tool syndrome, in terms of, you know, maybe I should publish something, maybe I should write, maybe I should create a video for YouTube, maybe I should do, like, I now know what I can say no to.
Mm.
And so even opportunities that seem to be potential money spinners, I'm happy to say no to them, mm-hmm. even without the money. Mm. It's really scary, but I can see that really clearly. And the writing has helped. One thing, or two things, I suppose, is just the whole idea of procrastination and perfectionism, which I know is just a universal problem, that whole imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
The writing has been very, very valuable for that. And here's why. Now that I have a thing, and I'm not blaming the technology, I could have a blog, but I don't know how to set it up. I don't know how to find the right photos. I don't know how to set up my email automation thing. All of that's in place now. And I realize that those are very often excuses. What I'm now seeing when I write is that I can write a blog post now in like 15 minutes and have it published, have it on my email list, have it on my blog, on my website, have it on a medium.com
mm-hmm.
publication, and it's just all done from the initial thought to publishing.
That is going to sound amazing to a lot of people, like very desirable in a good way. And they're also going to say, like, how the heck do you actually do that? So that's my question, is like, how are you able so fluidly to convert thinking into a blog post or an email?
Yeah. And so this comes down to the whole procrastination, perfectionism, is my blog post good enough thing. I work on the principle that if it's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. That's stolen from the early 20th century writer G.K. Chesterton. Mm. But you think about that in terms of anything, Philip. You think of it in terms of designing the perfect anything. In terms of dancing, singing, oh, yeah, look, I'd rather be an audience. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough yet to be going public. So I've made it through that mental barrier. I now judge myself not by how many drafts or how many brilliant ideas I've thought of, but how many I've published that are going to be seen by strangers. And I'm seeing things as assets. And so I'm not letting perfectionism or procrastination or imposter syndrome or anything like that get in my way anymore. And I'm, as you probably know, like many, many technical people, I tend to be a very detail focused, you know, very, you can tend to talk yourself, negotiate against yourself.
Right, right. Anything.
But then I think, well, you know, I am helping people and I'm seeing that feedback now. I am seeing that enthusiasm. I'm seeing that response. I'm seeing people coming back to me, even if it's not converting into dollars, people are coming back to me saying, Anthony, this really hit the mark. This made a change to me. I've actually implemented this. I used that line when I was talking to a customer and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that I'm doing that, I'm thinking, I can't be like the guy, the lifesaver, the lifeguard out on the beach, seeing somebody out there who's drowning and thinking, yeah, but my swim stroke isn't perfect, so I'm not going to go out and help.
You've come across something that is such a big topic for me, which is this idea of beginning before you are ready.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes I really, like, I recommend this a lot to people. And sometimes I doubt whether it's right for everybody, this idea of beginning before you're ready. But also, I just don't know any other way that's so accessible to almost anybody to get better at something than to just start doing it.
Well, just take a different swimming analogy. Supposing that I'm going to be the new Michael Phelps. Is he the big swimmer, the big Olympic gold?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. I think he's retired now, but he won so many Olympic gold medals.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid of the water. Well, the first step is not for me to be Michael Phelps. Hey, Philip, I am not getting into the water unless every race that I go in, I'm going to win.
Right.
Now, the first step is first be a little bit less afraid of the water and then go in the baby pool and then paddle. And so one thing that I've seen in terms of sales conversations, in terms of articles, in terms of measuring success and failure is that I don't see it as a binary decision. I see every single thing as just another seed in the garden that I have planted.
Mm-hmm.
No deal is death. If I lose this deal, there'll be another one come through.
Right.
So I am just developing skills along the way. In one of my crazy, desperate attempts at making money 2 or 3 years ago, I had this crazy idea of going to local businesses who had no money, the local pizza shop and the butcher, and recording videos, marketing videos, and charging them like $150 for that to put up on their web. And I'd never done any video. I was using my iPhone. I just had no clue, no business plan, nothing.
Right.
Just give you an idea of just how crazy and desperate I was to kind of get into marketing and to make some money without going back and getting a job.
Right.
And what that taught me was, see, that at one point I was recording videos. I tried to record an online course, and I think that's made me a grand total of like $70 now. So over 4 years. So, you know,
right.
But what that did, because I used to be very nervous on camera.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an introvert. Unlike almost everybody in your audience, I imagine, but
right.
I'm not. I don't identify as an introvert at all. But But one thing that it was that I was recording videos and I was embarrassed and I scratched myself there and I looked away, or one of the children came in and interrupted. Have to start it all again. And then I went from that point to being confident on video in 15 minutes. Would you like to know how I did that?
That would be interesting to hear the answer to.
I realized that I was comparing myself with Michael Phelps, or with, you know, one of the famous famous movie stars.
Right.
I was saying, look, I am not going to win an Academy Award for this video. Once I coped with that, once I actually realized that I was comparing myself with the best of the best, and I had to compare myself not with Michael Phelps, but with the guy who is too afraid to dip his toes in the water.
Right.
And I'm sitting there standing in the pool at least.
Right.
And then I thought, well, yeah, I'm not going to be as good as all of these people who are like really killing it. But hey, I can help this other guy who's this other lady, whoever it is, who's just behind me. I can help them out. And so to them, you know, my videos, that they'll be like super enthusiastic. They'll they'll just say, "Wow, look, I don't know how you do it. How do you create this content? How do you write so much?" And so once I actually got through that I gave up the this has got to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I went from being able to record, from being able to, you know, having to record like take, you know, a few hours to try and record a 15-minute video, to actually enjoying watching myself. And not many people get to that, including actors, but I actually enjoy watching myself on video.
Oh, that's great. There's a lot there, I think, for folks who are in a similar situation to learn from. How, Anthony, did you choose topics, whether it was a video or a blog article or anything like that? How do you choose topics? What do you decide to talk about?
Yeah, so I tend to be, I think, very creative in a non-technical sense. Like I don't have a design bone in my body, but in terms of creative ideas, if you were to talk about left brain, right brain, or, you know, the four different brain divisions of, you know, all of that pseudo neuroscience and so on, I've got that mixture, I think,
right,
of being creative outside of a technical world. So thinking of topics was probably more driven by impulse rather than any specific research.
Uh-huh.
But one thing that I just looking back, I can see that all of those tools and skills and little videos that I created for a YouTube channel that I hoped was going to go viral and got like 4 views. including my mom, you know, like I can look back now and say, look, at the time I had no clue. I thought that investing, learning that skill or thinking of that topic or being able to craft a message, being able to write a headline, I thought that was going to make me my $1 million.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't. But what it did do is looking back 2, 3, 4 years later, or sometimes even a month later, I can say I now have that skill.
Right.
I can now see why it's such a good thing that, like, if Philip Morgan invites me to a podcast, I just say yes without a moment's notice. Without a moment's hesitation, rather, I just say yes.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you did. So back to the the sort of the positioning journey. So you've, because we're jumping around the timeline, which is good, but I want to make sure folks can kind of track how this unfolded for you. So you've seen the end of the road for AIX work, and you're thinking, what can I do? You're writing. What happens around this time in terms of the next area in which you try out focusing?
Yeah. So learning as much as I can, reading, listening to podcasts, really participating in all of those kinds of things. And I really just started coaching people for free.
Okay.
Because there were others in the community who were in sometimes in dire straits, and or sometimes they thought they were and they weren't.
Uh-huh.
And then all roads lead back to positioning. And so I started putting people through the torture that you put all of us through. And but I sometimes do it without your gentleness.
Oh man, and you're even harder than I am.
I am. And I just say, look, here's some tough love from Uncle Anthony. And so I then and then I've got to eat my own dog food. Uh-huh. And just say, well, Anthony, stop saying, well, you can really help anyone. You're attracting a lot of attention, which I was, especially on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
I had, I was getting some videos a few months ago and some posts. I think one post, I think, had 20,000 views and loads of comments and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it still wasn't turning into business.
Okay.
And so I really saw that I had to become more focused myself in my positioning.
Okay.
So the message, and it's still an evolution. I said, look, I'm going to be helping. I didn't want to say the word IT.
Okay.
But I said technical firms, which is still very broad.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to help them. I'm going to help them learn to be more client focused in their language. So I'm going to help them really find the right clients, because they were extremely broad in their own language, especially in their writing.
Yeah.
Once they actually get in front of a customer, they're much better on their feet, but every time they write about it, they just get like super broad.
Right.
So I'd help them with three things. One is to find the right clients. Second is to talk their language, talk the client's language instead of techno babble.
Mm-hmm.
So that number three, they can make the sale.
So how did you give yourself the tough love of coming up with this positioning statement? Like what did it take to get to this point of, oh, that's who I'm trying to help and that's what I'm trying to help them with?
I would say it was probably external validation rather than something internally within me.
Okay. So what do you mean by that?
I mean that almost everybody that I trusted in or outside of my space, the people who I think I would like to be like them, I would like to be doing some coaching just like them.
Right.
Almost all of them said you have to narrow your focus.
Right.
And some of them have never even heard of you. I thought you invented that.
Nope.
That expression.
Nope.
And so one thing that I saw was that when I told people that I was from a technical background, it kind of worked for me and worked against me. It worked for me in this sense,
mm-hmm.
in that there was instant credibility.
Okay.
People assumed, especially outside the industry, but even inside the industry, they just, like, I didn't even have to mention it. I had a client a few months ago who was a SQL Server developer, and that's all he does. And he's like got 20 years of experience in that. And I said to him, do me a favor, because I've written like about 20 lines of SQL Server in my entire life. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know. I know at a high level what it means,
sure.
what it does. I said, do me a favor. Don't ever mention again to anybody that you're a SQL Server developer. What do you mean? That's what I do. That's my DNA. That's my entire life. I said, yeah, I know. But that's going to take, it's going to take you about 5 seconds to prove to the world that you know pretty much, like, you are absolutely the top of your game. You don't even have to mention it.
Right.
So it worked in favor of me in terms of my technical skill, because I had instant credibility with the technical people who felt that they did not know how to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to outsource that, just like they wanted to outsource anything that they didn't like.
Right.
Okay. And so they made some very bad choices. spent some money, kind of desperate things, just get me something, somebody go and take this pain away from me.
Right.
Because I do not want to learn how to sell. And my mission was to say, not only are you going to learn how to sell, you have to learn it first. You cannot outsource this yet. There are other things in your business you can outsource, but not this. You have got to own this.
That sounds almost, that sounds suspiciously like a point of view that you might have. So when you say that, at least at a certain stage, sales cannot be outsourced, you know, what's behind that for you? What are your reasons for saying that?
Well, it comes down to, you know, when people speak about accountability,
mm-hmm.
It comes down to sometimes that's a lack of ownership when people are saying that.
Mm.
I wish I had a magic bullet. I wish I could just get someone else to do this selling for me and let me focus on the technical side. And so I really, what I'm saying is, like, unless you understand the value that you're bringing to your client, how are you going to communicate that to your client? How are you going to communicate it to a salesperson?
Mm.
If you can't articulate that first, then like, if you don't sell, you don't eat.
Right.
And, but the IT side or the technical, especially the sysadmin, you know, more than the kind of development side, that background has also worked against me in ways that have quite surprised me, quite shocked me.
Oh, what do you mean?
Which is that when I say to people, you know, I'm helping technical people to sell,
mm-hmm.
almost universally, even people who have been through the journey, who have watched my journey, who have helped me but who are not technical, they are still, sometimes after several months, are still telling me, why don't you go and help out this company with their IT, with their Windows Server, uh-huh. stuff that I don't even know. And so they're still thinking of me as a hands-on guy.
Oh, very interesting. But why do you think that is? Like, what's giving them that signal? Is it because they know your history, or is it maybe something? Oh. Okay.
Yeah, probably. I think it's just the whole idea that, you know, if you're when you're outside the industry, you just think anyone inside the industry is an expert at everything.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah, I wonder if that will be less of a problem with when you start getting more strangers, you know, in your joining your list, it sort of in your marketing world. I wonder if that may be less of a problem.
Yes. It's probably more of a psychological problem for me, because I just sort of think, I have moved away from that. Can't you catch up?
Yeah. Don't you get it? That's exactly the sort of idea that I don't want to be pigeonholed. That's exactly what that is I don't want to be thought of. I don't want to be restricted in what I do in the future because of what I've done in the past.
Well, it is that, and it is the fear, and I understand that, but I really do not want to be doing IT work or technical. I tell people, you know, some of them say, oh, look, you can just fix up this, put this plugin onto your website, onto your WordPress. I tell them, if I never touch a computer again, except just to run my own business,
mm-hmm.
like if I never log on to my website again to do anything technical, like, I'll be a happy man.
Yeah.
And so that shows you the evolution mentally that I've gone through.
I'm curious if, I'm very curious about just the whole idea of how we age throughout our careers as self-employed people, especially those where at the beginning of the career, like this was true of me too. I was in system administration work in the 90s with the Windows servers. And it was thrilling at first because of the learning curve. And then it became not thrilling because the learning curve sort of flattened out.
Yep.
So I'm always interested to talk to people who are, you know, a little older and have seen a little more in their career. What do you make of the whole idea of like how you age well in technology?
Well, first, I think there's an enormous amount of hype around technology, and that when you actually get into the enterprise, there are, like, even if I just still dabble a little bit in at the enterprise level at some of the technical stuff that I do, there's hardly anything that I am doing now that I have that I didn't have all of the knowledge that I needed 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the developments, especially in particular in certain industries such as manufacturing, to a certain extent finance, like you're just not learning.
Right.
And so what you are learning is not technical stuff. Now, obviously this varies from one industry to another, and the startup world is a whole different ball game. But I think that I really stopped learning anything technical. And started saying, well, how do I craft this? How do I turn this into training? How do I help out my colleagues in non-technical ways, emotionally and other things like that? So, yeah, I think you do get to a stage. It's not so much that I've been left behind by the technology, that I can't keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's that it just doesn't keep up with my enthusiasm, my desire to be connecting with people, and not to be sort of buried all night on the command line. Like, it just
I want to meet someone who says the first part of what you said. Yeah, I stopped learning 10 years ago, and then goes on to say, and that was awesome because, or whatever reason. Like, I've never met anybody in the sort of world that we occupy who would say that. They would say that was a problem if I stopped learning, or I hated it and I felt stuck, or you know, some variation of that. It would be a negative thing if they stopped learning. And it sounds like that was for you too.
Well, looking back now, I still remember the moment that I actually spent some money on my business other than, you know, having a basic website and so on. I still remember the moment that I paid $9 for a webinar.
Mm-hmm.
And I still remember that decision. It's crazy now because I spent, you know, at least four figures.
Sure.
And plus a truckload of time on developing myself and on learning now. But at the time, I still remember that was a turning point for me. That $9 decision. I'm actually spending something here that is for personal development, that I this is building up me and my business. Like, that was a, for a former employee, that was a really big turning point for me.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. And to be clear, that's because you felt sort of stagnant, and this was like, I'm getting out of this stagnation, I'm changing things.
Yeah, well, I was already doing that, but I was reading. It was a crossover from reading more and more free material,
right,
and getting free advice,
right,
to actually investing in myself,
right,
a full $9,
a full $9.
But I remember the moment I made that decision, Philip. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's something they say in the world of marketing, that the biggest chasm there is between people who will never spend any money on something and people who will spend at least a penny on it. And so you sort of crossed that chasm, it sounds like, at that moment.
It's been really interesting seeing, how can you say the word, in terms of engagement, in terms of people responding. That is so important for my writing, getting that feedback. And so that's why I publish before I'm ready. You know, draft for me is a failure. If I've got a draft of something in there, that's death. That's defeat. Is that having a draft idea? I actually get it out there in front of some strangers,
yeah,
in front of strange eyeballs. And once I've actually done that, I know that I haven't necessarily made a big, you know, I'm not going to make a sale from it, but I have certainly made it a really big, well, I've planted a seed and I've built an asset.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
I do. I mean, I'm a big believer in that. So what does feedback look like for you right now in your business? Is that people commenting on something on LinkedIn or responding to emails? What specifically?
Yeah, primarily the feedback is going to be through people opting in to the email.
Okay.
Certainly responding, replying on LinkedIn, but I understand, and it took me quite a while to understand that my value is in my email list.
Mm.
All right, is that those people are coming in? I'm getting open rates of between 41% and 64%,
mm-hmm.
which I'm very happy with.
That's wonderful.
And so that means people are opening it. My unsubscribe rates are, you know, negligible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's good. And so the next thing is, well, okay, people are seeing repeated value from, so I suppose here is the maturity of, you know, a long-term view, Philip, is that now that I can look back, and especially as a father, we've got 7 children, my wife and I.
Right.
I can kind of look back and realize that, like, no deal is death, no small thing, like no small catastrophe. Like, it's not really a catastrophe.
Mm.
Sometimes the little children can panic, and you see that as a father, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the children panic, and you realize, you know, this is not as big a deal. Let's take a longer term view. Don't look at it as success or failure. And just look at every little incremental step as something, as a thing in itself that you've done, and somehow it's building the building. It's another brick in the building.
Yeah. So, looking back over the last, I don't know, let's say 3 years, is there something that you wish you could have traveled back in time and told yourself, "Don't do that. It's a waste of time," or Is everything now, do you see it as, well, it maybe didn't go where I wanted it to go, but it contributed something to this overall thing I'm building?
I have both.
Okay.
Where I can see very quickly now, if somebody suggests, for example, last week somebody tempted me to, or a few people kind of tempted me to start a podcast.
Uh-huh.
And I was always resistant to that idea. I'm totally happy to, you know, to get on camera, get on microphone and record something. But I can easily dismiss that idea, not because I'm afraid of it, but because I think, well, how is this part of my big strategy here? So I can easily write off a particular opportunity for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, that's something that I wish I had learnt much more quickly. But then on the other hand, I can also see the positive that every single experience, every single conversation, even those sales conversations where I so hoped it would turn into a deal and I totally didn't get anything from it.
Yeah.
And whether it was my own fault or theirs or, you know, for whatever reason, I can still see, like, this was super valuable.
Right.
So that's been a big mental shift for me, is that I don't see anything as a waste of time now. I don't see anything as a failure. I see it just as another data point.
Yeah. I think that's part of the growth mindset, you know.
Good.
I do. Okay. So this story is still unfolding. You feel like you're getting more traction now than you have before, but you're still in that stage of sort of clarifying. Like, what do you think still is yet to be figured out for you?
Okay, so I'm a very disorganized person, and having read books such as The E-Myth by Michael E. Gerber, mm-hmm. and the checklist manifesto. I've now got some cards. I'm now getting myself organized because I can see that part of my business, the detail side. Like I get attracted by the creative ideas,
right?
But yeah, and so getting discipline into my business has been a really, really big thing. Mm. And my vision at the moment, and I'm doing this a bit on the fly here, but that's okay. So my vision is particularly to help, I would actually say, fathers who are in their own business, mm-hmm. who are kind of just adrift because their career is falling apart or has fallen apart.
Mm-hmm.
They have stumbled into consulting or maybe made it as a deliberate choice, but without really any clue, is to help them to craft their message in a really, really powerful way for their clients, because they're just able to provide amazing value. And but they're still in a very much in an employee mindset and in a scarcity mindset. And so helping them with three things, I suppose. Number one is the mindset itself. And that sometimes can be a bit of a nervous or a less compelling thing, particularly for technical people, because they tend not to want to be so self-focused.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is the skill set. So I can actually help them with things like, I don't mean the technical skills, but the actual, how do I write a headline? How do I write an email? What should I write? How do I put this together? How do I turn this message into an email course and have it out by this time next week?
Right.
So the mindset, the skill set. And then the third thing, I don't like the word accountability, but implementation, execution, just somehow actually getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like an anti-procrastination pill that I give them.
Right.
Where I teach them, I just say, like David C. Baker says, look, don't wait until you're confident. It's not going to happen. Like, just you don't wait until you feel confident, because, like, it's that doesn't work. I just say, look, people tell me, look, but I don't feel confident. I say, yeah, well, tell me why that matters.
Oh.
I actually don't care whether you feel confident or not, okay?
That's great. What do people say when you ask, tell me why that matters?
I just say, look, if we're waiting for your confidence, okay, I don't care. It's not up to you. You are not the buyer here.
Mm.
Your customer is the buyer. You're not making the buying decision. The customer is. Are you seeing – well, you're not seeing – this is a failure for you to see things through the customer's eyes. The customer is seeing the value here.
Mm.
And that's and I'm just going with whoever's paying the money to you. I do not care whether you think it's worth it. The customer does.
That's great.
So get out of your own headspace. And, in fact, even in dealing with imposter syndrome, I tell people, look, you want to go and tell yourself that you're no good, that you're a fraud, that you're an imposter, that you shouldn't actually be here. If only people really knew what you were like. I don't care. You go do that in the mirror. You can go, I don't care. I'm not going to tell you to make affirmations about how good you are. Go tell yourself what a failure you are. I don't care. But at the moment, we've got a paying customer who needs your help.
Mm.
And so you go do that on your own time, not on the boss's time, because the client is your boss.
I love the tough love. So, Anthony, where can folks find out more, perhaps join your email list and see what you're doing there? Where would you send them?
Yeah, so the email list is going to be the place to find me. I actually have a short six-part email course on how to win more business. And we'll include the link in the show notes. I do have a website. My name is anthonyenglish.com.au. The AU is for Australia.
That's my conversation with Anthony English. Hey, if you know someone who is at a similar point in their journey as Anthony and would benefit from feeling less alone in that self-employment journey, Do me a favor, reach down to your podcast player app, hit the share button, and send this episode to them directly. I really appreciate it.